Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum. So gather around the radio, boys and girls. Fire up the Bunsen burners and get ready for an hour of scintillating Wait. Got a note here from the legal department. Do not fire up the Bunsen burners. Do not do that. A number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can also post your comments below today's Vox Pop wall post on the old Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop if you wish. You can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number to call is 800-348-2551. And you want to talk brilliant scientists. Oh, scientists, sign in, please. Not one brilliant one in the house here.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
Hi, Jim.
I'm George Shaw. I'm a geologist, geophysicist.
Ed Stander, and I do everything that anybody else doesn't do.
Well, great to have you guys here today. And Barbara Brabbitt's not here today, one of our regulars, and she's working.
More irregular than regular, but still.
There you go. But she's working. But I hope she's listening while she works.
Oh, yeah. She'll be sitting there and saying, no, that's not true.
That's right. Like she does when she's here, as a matter of fact. Our number to call is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Francis. Francis, where are you calling from?
Adams.
You're on.
My question is this. If you had a plumb line hanging from, say, a tree at exactly noon, would the shadow that it casts point dead north?
By definition, if you do that on solar noon, yes.
But solar if you do it, noon?
But yeah, that's when the sun is the highest in the sky. But not necessarily by the clock. Because of time zones,
right, and daylight savings time, et cetera, yeah. Puts it off as well. If one of the neat things you can do, actually, if you put a stick in the ground, for example, and look for the shortest shadow, that puts it at high noon as far as the sun is concerned, which is never the same as on your clock.
Mm-hmm.
One caveat.
Is there a way to find out when solar noon is in this area?
Well, you can look it up online. That would give you the information. Or you could simply stick a stick in the ground and wait till it gets to the shortest point.
George, you had a caveat.
Yeah, if you're in the southern hemisphere, it points toward the South Pole.
Well, there you go. Well, Francis, thanks a lot for the call. This one came in via email from Joel in Port Jervis, who writes, when I turn on my microwave oven, the turntable turns clockwise. If I turn it off and turn it back, the turntable turns counterclockwise. I have a convection oven with a rotisserie. The rotisserie does the same thing. Why do they do that? And that's from Joel.
I've noticed that, too, and I've wondered exactly the same thing. Why would they do that? Well, and I don't know.
Ed, you're good at making things up. What's the answer?
Well, from what I've seen, it's not... At least the microwave that I have doesn't just do clockwise, counterclockwise. It does clockwise sometimes, then clockwise another time, and then counterclockwise. And in that respect, it just depends on which way the motor decides to go when it starts. But why I should do clockwise and then counterclockwise, that I couldn't tell you.
Okay. And why would the motor change its mind?
Well, it depends on a little bit of... George, why don't you say something? I think it depends on the inertia of the system, whether there's any little... The little push at the beginning that gets it started. I used to have a motor that I could do that with. If I pushed it a little bit in one direction, it would go that way. Push it a little the other direction, it would go the other direction.
So there are little people inside the microwave giving it a little push?
No, it just depends on how close it is to the fixed magnets that are on the outside of it.
Jim, you were shaking your head there.
I was wondering if it's a difference between AC and DC motors. Because usually motors will start and turn just one direction.
That's true. And when you think about it, it's a DC motor that has the commutator in it, yeah, which is the effectively a series of magnets that it starts off with. So depending on whether it's close to one or the other, it'll go in that direction.
Now, if you have a toaster south of the equator, will the toast point down when they come out, the pieces of toast?
I see. I understand now where we're at.
All right. Let's go to Gary in Schenectady. Gary, you're on.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. This is my favorite Vox Pop program, that's for sure. And
wow.
I'm gonna ask our esteemed panel to put on their zoology hats, if they would, for a moment.
Oh, I like this, yes.
Having lived in the Northeast all my life, I'm well aware that our black bears, most of whom live in the Adirondacks and Catskills, they sleep all winter long. They are true hibernators. Likewise, having lived out in the country, I know woodchucks, which we call groundhogs, are likewise true hibernators. So I assume are our bats, because they would have nothing to eat during the winter time. So they're in their caves hibernating. Mm-hmm. Except for those three mammal species, and I'm only speaking of mammals now, are there any other true hibernators in the Northeast?
I do not know.
I think we'll have to take that one because we don't have any biologists
here
today.
Yeah, Barbara's not here today. I tell you what.
I
suspect we'll get an email from Barbara anytime with the answer to that question. So hang in there, Gary. Thank you for the call.
Okay, I listen. Thank you so much.
By the way, our producer handed me this note. Go to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration website for Solar Noon Calculator.
Right.
So it's NOAA, NOAA.gov.
The other place to get it would be the Naval Observatory.
Oh, that's another spot. Let's go to Tom in Saratoga. Tom.
Yeah, I had a question regarding reverse osmosis filters for drinking water and what they will filter out.
Reverse osmosis system for drinking water and what it will filter out.
They'll filter out virtually everything because the pores are small enough to exclude ions.
Okay, so explain to us what a reverse osmosis system is.
Reverse osmosis, there is a membrane through which water can pass, but virtually nothing else.
So it's like a coffee filter?
You can think of it like that. And then under a great deal of pressure, the water can be pushed through it so that essentially pure water comes on one side and the other stuff remains on the other. Now, to increase the efficiency, the membranes aren't made totally exclusive. So they, depending on what would be the design of the membrane, they might remove 95 or 99% of the ions. But in principle, they can remove everything.
And that's why there's different membranes for well water as compared to city water, et cetera.
Interesting. The filtration systems have been much in the news lately with the PFOA situation in Rensselaer County and in North Bennington as well. And so we often hear about a charcoal filtration system. What, in fact, is the charcoal doing when it filters water?
The charcoal has a great deal of surface area to it, and molecules like, organic molecules, like POFA, absorb strongly on the surface. So it just kind of blots them up like water on a paper towel, because those molecules will stick onto that surface of the charcoal.
So it's fairly effective?
Yes.
So, in other words, if you were in a town where there were some questionable drinking water, that would be a thing to have?
I believe so, yeah.
Right. As long as you backwash it.
What do you mean?
Well, you have to. There's a limited lifetime. It can only absorb so much. So you'd either have to replace the activated charcoal element periodically, or you conceivably could rinse it out or wash it out. But buying a new one is the clever way to do it.
Yeah. If you have an aquarium, you have a charcoal filter in that too.
Now, is that the same as the commercially available filters you see in the pitchers? You buy them in the store and you filter your water?
You can get them commercially. Yeah. I have one in my basement.
Oh, really? It just filters the water coming in?
Yep. Yeah, I have a whole house one at my house, effectively, to get rid of the chlorine in the water coming into town. Mm. And it does a beautiful job.
I live in the same town, and there is smell the chlorine.
Yeah, you can't shower with it that way. It's nice.
This is Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum. Number to call here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. This is one that came in via email from Paul, who says, isn't it just a great coincidence that the moon is just the right distance from the Earth so as to create the solar eclipse that some people got to see the other day? What would it be like if the moon was substantially closer or farther away? And that's from Paul.
Well, if it's further away, you don't get total solar eclipses. You'd still get lunar eclipses. And if it were larger, you would get more frequent, and the blotting of the moon would be even more extreme than it is.
Mm. Yeah, it's actually amazing. Right now, I think the longest solar eclipse on record is like 11 minutes long.
Okay, explain to us. Now, I was watching a video of this. Explain to us what happens, why the duration is relatively short for a solar eclipse. And I was watching the map as it basically showed where the eclipse moved, or as the Earth was turning, you could see the eclipse move on the map. So explain what happens before we take a break here.
Well, the moon is 400 times closer than the sun. It's also 400 times smaller. And so it blocks the sun almost precisely. And that just happens to be because the moon is in the right location to do that. It used to be much closer, and in a number of years it's going to be much further away because it's moving away from us at about an inch and a half a year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just at that location. And as it goes, effectively it goes between the sun and the Earth, the shadow focuses on the Earth. It's about 150 miles in diameter. Mm. So you have to be within that 150-mile circle to actually get it blocked. So it's a cosmic coincidence, really.
It's 400 times smaller as we see it, right? It's much, much, much smaller in actual terms.
Right.
It's the Science Forum. We're joined today by Ed Stander, George Shaw, and Jim Pickett. And you at home, 800-348-2551. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Comes from Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, offering wine and craft spirits from around the globe and from local artisans with weekly tastings. Stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins. GrapesandGrainsWine.com. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their updated website with more information about membership, grants, and loans. So our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. And ClipCentric, Albany, a local video services division of ClipCentric, producing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV. Albany.clipcentric.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, and it's the Science Forum. Number to call here is 800-348-2551. Brilliant, eminent scientists are here. They're looking around to see which one is the eminent one. Let's go to Phil in Poughkeepsie. Phil.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I'm responding to your question about why the microwave turntable turns one direction one time and one direction the next time. I believe it's because the microwaves that are coming into the cooking area aren't uniformly distributed around the food. And if you just went around in one direction, it would only bathe them in one way, whereas if the food goes around in the other direction, then it comes in, the waves are able to address it in a different way. The same with a rotisserie. The heat isn't even in the box, and if the food comes out in a different direction, I think that's the manufacturers do that on purpose to make the food cook more evenly when you're doing repeated cycling.
That's a good idea, except for one problem. And that's it. It only changes direction when you turn it off and put it back on again.
Right. So you nuke your food, you take it out, you stir it like they tell you to, you put it back in, you turn it on again. Now it goes the other way to give the food the waves in a different direction. That's just my read on that.
Interesting. Well, Phil, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Over to David in, where are you calling from, David?
Johnstown.
It's a Johnston. But
Okay.
You're calling and you're on.
Another dumb question. But anyway, my favorite place in the world is Saratoga Springs. However, is it Yosemite Park East? Is there a volcano underneath Saratoga Springs?
No.
There isn't? Oh, God. Where's the bubbly water coming from?
Yeah, great question.
It's actually groundwater.
Yeah, if it were
relatively shallow groundwater, and it picks up carbon dioxide and comes out bubbly.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you.
All right, so David, you've seen the show on the super volcano out there, and you're scared?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a pretty frightening prospect, that super volcano.
I know it is. Thank you.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Right over to Kurt in Vermont. Kurt, you're on.
Oh, hello, guys. How you doing?
Good.
This might be another dumb question, and you probably have already covered it in other shows. But
there are no dumb questions, only dumb answers.
We've got those.
Yeah, we've got dumb radio hosts, too, so we're all set.
Good deal. Well, I'd fit right in with you guys. But anyways, it's my understanding that the light from the sun takes about 8 minutes for us to view it. Is that correct?
That's right.
So am I correct in thinking then that when we have a sunset time of 5:08, let's say, the sun really set at 5 o'clock, and we're, our perception is that it sets at 5:08?
No, we define sunset as when the sun apparently disappears. So it's a matter of definition. But you're right. When you see it, when this last little bit of sun disappears, the actual angular position of the sun is below the horizon by 8 minutes worth.
Right. It was already gone 8 minutes ago.
It may actually be more than that because you've got a mirage effect associated with the with the atmosphere.
That's right. Because the light diffracts to the atmosphere, the angle bends down a little bit.
Gotcha.
So the sun is really below the horizon. Now, it's not a matter that the sun or the apparent position of the sun is different. It's a matter that the light that you saw came from the sun eight minutes earlier.
Here's a question for you, too. How about this one? How long do you think it takes for the light to get out of the sun? The light that actually was produced by nuclear reactions in the center of the sun. Guess how long it takes for that light to get out of the sun?
No idea.
Take a guess.
12 minutes.
We got 12 minutes. Anybody for 10?
All right.
It takes about 150 to 200,000 years.
No way!
Yep.
How about that?
Yep. So the sun you're actually seeing, the light you're actually seeing, is 200,000 in 8 minutes long.
All right, well, I just got a lot more than I bargained for.
Well, thanks, Kurt. We appreciate the call. You see what happens? It's your own fault for calling. Thank you. 800-348-2551 is the number.
So nobody's going to ask me why? It takes 200,000 years?
Let me give the number, and then I'll ask why.
All right.
800-348-2551. Ed, why?
Because light forming in the center of the sun has to get out, and electrons in the sun are very, very good at gobbling up that light, of effectively absorbing it.
Mm-hmm.
And when they let it go, they send it off in any direction that they want to.
Right.
So it's like a night's walk or what's called a drunkard's walk. Sometimes the light gets sent out towards the sun. Sometimes it gets sent out towards the edge. Sometimes it goes back to the center. And on average, it takes about 200,000 years, which is a good thing because every time it gets eaten up by an electron, it loses a little bit of energy. And if it didn't, if it all came out at once, we'd be bathed in gamma rays.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, so it is a good thing.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's get back briefly to the supervolcano.
Oh, right.
So explain to me, those of you who know, what is at work there and why some people are so disturbed by this prospect?
You'll have to tell me what you mean by a supervolcano.
The supervolcano at Yosemite. Yellowstone, excuse me.
Oh.
Because it'll ruin everybody's day when it goes off.
Right.
Well, the supervolcano, and since George won't answer, I'll
answer
for him. Yeah,
apparently not.
The supervolcano is forming over what's called a hot spot or a mantle plume. And it's effectively a forming at the mantle crust interface. And as the Earth moves over the top of it, it stays effectively in the same place. So it's been moving from around Oregon and moving towards Yosemite for a very long time.
Right.
And the last time it went off, it pretty well bathed the entire western United States in ash, and some places to an enormous depth. I mean, Yellowstone.
How enormous of a depth?
Well, Yellowstone's called Yellowstone because of the ash that's there. And
really?
That's hundreds of feet thick.
So we've seen many estimates of what damage it would cause if it eventually it will go, but if it goes in our lifetime, and they say even on the East Coast there would be a rather thick layer of ash.
Yeah.
One thing, you recall it a super volcano. It's actually a super volcanic eruption, and Yellowstone is only one example of a place where this has occurred. And in fact, there have been more recent ones that have been very, very large volcanic explosions. What we're really talking about is a single volcanic explosion, which is caused by the enormous buildup of pressure. The pressure is trapped. It doesn't get released, the material, and the heat doesn't get released all at once. It builds up, and then it blows up in a single event. And Mount Tambora in 1815 blew up in Indonesia, and it created an effect. It put so much material into the atmosphere that it created what came to be known as the year without a summer, that every month of the subsequent year in the Northern Hemisphere, there were temperatures, there were frosts in the United States.
Hmm. And 11,000 people wound up dying in England as a result of it.
Wow.
From lack of food.
Now, could you compare the hot spot that's under Yellowstone to the hot spots, say, under Hawaii or Iceland?
Well, in a way, they're similar. The thing is, with Hawaii and Iceland, you don't have thick continental crust to kind of trap the energy below the surface and to build up the pressure. There, the pressure is released much more readily, and so we don't get the big explosions there.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Before we get back to the phones, this one came in via email from Anne, who says, I think you said you have a geologist there today. Boy, do we. So I have a couple questions. A friend gave me a Herkimer diamond, said it wasn't worth anything. How can that be? Diamonds seem to be pretty pricey elsewhere. On my hikes, oh, that's the first question. Second question, on my hikes, I see all sorts of massive, gorgeous boulders, and I'm wondering what they are. I suspect most that what I see are granite. Also, lots of bright white marble rocks around, too, that look like the one in Natural Bridge State Park in North Adams. Is that really marble? Which one do you want to go for first, Herkimer diamonds or boulders?
Well, the Herkimer diamond is actually a what's called a doubly terminated quartz crystal. It's actually quartz. It's not a diamond that's made out of carbon produced at high pressure. And so quartz crystals are far more common than diamonds. They form under conditions that are easier to obtain in the earth, near the Earth's surface.
But they're valuable in their own right. They have uses.
Well, they not so much they have uses, but people like to collect them. And so they have some monetary value for people who collect them.
Well, isn't quartz crystal, can't you make?
They're everywhere. But
yeah.
Doubly terminated quartz crystals are rare because they actually have to form within a cavity and float within that cavity. Otherwise, they'll form on the edge of the vug or the hole outwards. But the fact that they're doubly terminated means that collectors really appreciate them.
Okay. And then the other question was about the massive, gorgeous boulders, wondering what they are. Anne suspects they are granite and also a lot of bright white marble rocks around, too.
Right. Well,
is it really marble? That's
no.
What she wants
the,
to know.
We're here in the Northeast. We're sitting on about 75 feet of Canadian soil.
Okay.
That's all was brought down by the glaciers. And most of the granite boulders that you find around here are from the Canadian Shield. The beautifully white rocks are probably Potsdam sandstone.
Mm.
And they come down as well from the northern area brought down by the glaciers.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Jeff in Utica. Jeff, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to offer what I think is a clarification. The discussion of the apparent size of the moon and the sun, the closing comment was that the actual size was 400 times smaller, so the apparent size was the same. Just wanted to clarify, that's the apparent diameter. So,
right.
Or actually, the actual diameter is 400 times smaller. The actual volume is radically smaller still.
Yes, the scientist actually answered my question during the break, but not on the air. So we appreciate that.
You just had to be here.
Okay.
Thanks,
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening in Utica. We appreciate it. James in Highland. James, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you much. My question is, especially with today's boring technologies that are available to us and different types of high-tempered metals, how come no one's ever tried to tap into a volcano or tap into the natural heat from the earth to generate steam to power a turbine to generate electricity?
Well, this has been done. It's been done in Italy, New Zealand, and right here in the United States in the place called the Geysers in California. And these are often associated with comparatively recent volcanic activity, but not usually in the immediate vicinity of an active volcano. An active volcano is a little bit harder thing to deal with. You definitely don't want to drill into a magma chamber because that would be too exciting. But we do, in fact, generate geothermal energy by raising steam or using steam that's naturally occurring and running it through turbines. So the answer to your question is it is done, in fact.
Yeah, the best example of that actually is Iceland and Reykjavik, where if you fly over, there's not one smokestack in the whole place. It's all run by geothermal activity underneath the island.
Okay. Hey, James, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
So there was a, I think it was Russia. Yeah, I think it was Russia. A news item that they are attempting in a spot where the crust is very thin, relatively thin, to drill through that crust. And of course, not knowing anything about this, really, I thought, oh my gosh, maybe you don't want to go all the way through the crust. Is that a
scary proposition? They tried to do it in Spain years and years ago.
Yeah.
In a project called Project Mojo. And they got quite a ways down, and then they had to stop because a movie came out called A Crack in the Earth.
Yeah, I remember that movie.
Where they made a big hole, and they blew up an atomic bomb at the bottom of it, and half the Earth spirals off into space.
Yeah.
Well, the folks at the UN saw that and said that this doesn't sound like a good thing to do to us, so they actually canceled the project. But the Russians have, for years, have been digging deep holes. A bunch of Swedes a number of years ago convinced, I don't know how they did it, but they convinced a bunch of Russians that if they drilled deep enough anywhere on the Earth, they'd hit oil.
Ah.
And they went down, I think, 2 miles.
More than that.
Yeah, they went enormous way. Of course, they didn't hit any oil. They were going through a granite body.
But is there any danger of doing that, going through the crust?
Well, it's very difficult to drill to the bottom of the continental crust because that's 40 kilometers.
But aren't there spots where it's thinner?
Average. If you go into the ocean basins, then it's much thicker. And in fact, there is a project being proposed to try to drill to the upper mantle through ocean crust.
Why would you
want
to do
it? Proposed before. Well, part of it, I think, is the challenge, but the idea is to have a complete section of the crust from top to bottom, and then some samples of the upper mantle rocks that are pristine and that have been collected in situ.
And see, the mantle is solid, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Except where there are the plumes coming up, but for the most part, it's solid down a long way until you get to the liquid core of the
Earth. And the only samples that we really have of the mantle right now that are anything to talk about are things that come up with kimberlites, which are the tubes that come up at very high speed, something on the order of the speed of sound.
Wow.
And they're the ones that contain diamonds.
All right, let's get another call in here before the next break. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Richard in Colony. Richard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Last summer, a woman called in because she saw late lights on Lake George
that.
At night.
Yeah.
And nobody had a response for that because what it actually is we race sailboats at night on Lake George. And in order to see the sail, we have to illuminate the sail with a spotlight. And we'll do that for 3 or 4 minutes at a time. And from the shore, it looks like this really weird light just cruising across the lake.
Oh, that's neat. Why do you race sailboats at night?
Because it's fun.
Fair enough. All right. Thank you, Richard. We appreciate
it. I figured
that.
I just didn't want to say it.
Thanks
Not
for the
problem.
Call. Bye now. Have a good one. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Rick in Warren, Massachusetts. Rick, you're on.
Hi. I do pottery programs in elementary and high schools. And when I demonstrate on the wheel, I relate historical, geological, science, technology, especially to high school students who are looking at careers. And I am hoping that maybe if you were standing next to me and while I'm throwing and I'm talking about applying simple pottery to maybe to a career where you would consider arts and science being related as a pursuit for a high school student.
I think they've always been related, and you touched on one aspect of it, namely the techniques. And this, I think you are very clearly are aware of how this applies to something like pottery, where the technology of producing glazes and changes in properties due to firing. But it's also true in other artistic areas, selecting a stone for sculpting depends on having some knowledge of how the stone looks or how it might look. Selecting paints, pigments, this is all connected. At the same time, the other angle of this is that is that people don't usually think of science as being a creative enterprise, but it requires a substantial amount of imagination and mental creativity to do science and engineering, by the way. And this is certainly something we recognize in terms of the arts and music. So this trying to divide science and art into separate categories is a convenient thing to do, maybe for categorizing things, but we should not lose sight of the fact that there's a lot in common with what people are doing.
Hey, Rick, great call. We appreciate the call very much. But isn't there a portion of art that is almost a mystical, something from another to accomplish art? In other words, you can have all the technique in the world. You can spin the pottery wheel perfectly, but if you don't have that tapping into that other place, it's not art, right?
Well, I think that's where the creativity comes from, and who knows exactly what that has something to do with human intuition. Hmm. But don't get the idea that isn't true in terms of doing science again or even engineering. There's that spark of insight that occurs that, aha, that's what we're trying to get here. That's what looks like to be the right answer.
It's the Vox Pop Science Forum. Our number to call is 800-348-2551. Back, more of your calls, the home stretch coming up.
Support comes from the Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for 25 years, independent living in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley. Lathrop.Kendall.org. Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more. Waterwheelvillage.com. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades. ShannonRose.com. The Whistling Kettle, Troy and Ballston Spa, featuring 16 new teas for 2016, including Aztec Spice, a warming tea with cocoa, cinnamon, and chili flakes. TheWhistlingKettle.com. And Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenAndPerrin.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Some 70s detective music here for the Vox Pop Science Forum. All right, it's incongruous, but who cares? All right, this one came in via email, and this is from Paula regarding charcoal filters versus reverse osmosis. Is it not true that reverse osmosis filters will remove bacteria from water while charcoal filters will not? So you should only use charcoal filters with potable water, right? Oh, it's actually from Bob.
Oh, good. Hi, Bob.
It's not Paul, it's Bob. All right. So that's the question.
Charcoal filters have a different function. If you want to remove bacteria from the water, you either have to chemically treat it or use a filtration system that will, in fact, trap particles of that size. And both techniques are possible.
Okay.
Yeah. Some arctic carbon filters actually contain silver for that reason.
Silver is the key?
Yeah. It knocks out the bacteria. So you don't get, because otherwise activated carbon can produce colonies. You can actually colonize it with bacteria, which can cause a major problem.
Oh, very interesting. Let's go to Sean in Kinderhook. Sean.
I have like a fun fact. I read somewhere that during the last ice age, the ice in Manhattan was as thick as two Empire State Buildings. Is this true?
Well, the Empire State Building wasn't there then, so it's...
Okay.
I know, but what I'm saying is they said that, you know, back during the last ice age, that the ice was that thick. Like, in Manhattan, that's how thick the ice was.
I would have thought it would be even thicker.
Well, actually, it depends on where you are and which stage of the last glaciation you're talking about. Up here around Albany, I've been doing some work trying to figure out how thick the ice has been around here, and probably it was no thicker than 300 or 400 feet during the last ice age, during the last section of the Wisconsin glaciation.
Which was 10,000 years ago it ended? But
yeah,
when,
about 10,000 years ago.
Okay.
So earlier glaciations, certainly. I mean, at one time, as you're probably aware, a lot of Canada wound up down on Long Island. Long Island is just a terminal moraine of one of the glacial periods. So it depends on which part of the glaciation you're talking about.
Well, in Greenland, they say that it's almost 5 miles thick.
In places, it might be almost. I don't know. 5 miles seems a bit on the high side, but it could be. Yeah. There are deep valleys in parts of underneath the ice in parts of Greenland. So in those locations, it might be thicker. And in fact, if we go back to the last Wisconsin and maximum, we know that the ice, say here in Albany, was probably 1,500 feet thick. And the reason
how
we
long
know
ago that, was that at the maximum?
What, 20,000, 30,000
years ago.
Yeah. Okay.
We know that because the ice actually covered parts of what's now Thatcher Park. So it had to be at least deep enough to fill up the valley between Thatcher Park and the Berkshires and then have some left over for depositing sediments on top.
So that was 20 to 30,000 years ago. And then the ice age effectively was over 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like an awful lot of ice to disappear or go back. How does it work that fast?
We have a lot of very deep valleys that were carved by the water that came out of those glaciers. They melted very fast.
But what happened that the, in other words, it was obviously very cold. We had 1,500 feet of ice in this area at the maximum of the last ice age.
Right.
And then within 20,000 years of that, it's all gone.
Well, it doesn't take all that long to melt ice. Just take a look at your drink and ask yourself, how long does it take those ice cubes to disappear? You know, that's something you can observe very easily. And yes, a glacier seems like a really huge thing, and it is compared to an ice cube in a glass of water. But so long as you got temperatures above freezing, that ice is going to be melting.
Yeah, so what was that work that warmed everything up so much? There were no coal-fired power plants at the time, presumably.
There was a Russian named Milutin Milankovic who did some studies, and he argued that the reason for it depended on where the Earth was with respect to the sun and the tilt of the Earth at a particular time. And he was able to show that a lot of the interglacial and glacial periods, the variation that we saw, was related to how close we were to the sun or what the tilt of the Earth
Interesting.
Was.
Interesting. Well, in the 70s, if you guys may recall, maybe it was Time, maybe it was Newsweek, maybe it was both, where they had The Coming Ice Age on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
When's the next one due? Obviously, it didn't come in the 70s because I was here.
Several thousand years. Even back in the 70s, they were saying, well, you know, the orbital periodicities associated with the moon, the Earth, and the sun mm-hmm. are something that are highly predictable. So we can project that into the future. And there are certain configurations which lead to excess cooling in the northern hemisphere. That's really the crux, because the northern hemisphere has more land mass, more places for ice to build up. And knowing that, they were saying, well, based on the orbital periodicities, sometime in the next several thousand years,
okay.
usually not done very precisely, the orbital alignment will be such that we would expect cooling.
Right. All right, let's go to Amelia in Great Barrington. Amelia, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, how was daylight savings developed? And, like, how was it determined that it was developed?
Well, if I remember right, daylight savings time developed simply because they wanted to make sure that there was enough light in the morning that school children, for example, wouldn't have a problem getting to school in the dark. And so they developed the idea of changing the clock just enough so that light during the winter, the sun would rise a little bit earlier than it would otherwise. And that was basically the premise. A number of years ago, when I was living in Newfoundland, they tried to have double daylight savings time. So instead of 1 hour and a half different, they made it 2.5 hours. And the government collapsed because of that.
Really?
Yeah, because by having double daylight savings time, people in Canada, in Newfoundland, couldn't watch Hockey Night in Canada before they had to go to bed. So the government collapsed because of that.
That's funny. Thank you, Amelia.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye now. over to, we lost Amelia, we lost Katrina. Let's go to Bill in Hudson. Bill, you're on.
Yes. A few years ago, after the Deepwater Horizon spill,
yep.
I read that they capped that blown well with concrete. And I'm wondering if you guys know if that's true. And is that something that's they can really consider to be a long-term solution? I mean, I know concrete can be pretty strong even underwater, but can we rely on something like that?
I think the short answer is yes. One of the problems with the oil and gas industry is abandoned wells. When the wells are no longer productive, or if a drilled well doesn't strike a sufficiently rich deposit, the petroleum or the gas company would often walk away in the past. Now there are regulations that saying you have to seal these wells off. Unfortunately, there's still any huge number, thousands if not tens of thousands of wells that were previously abandoned, and we don't even know where the wellhead is. So these are potential problems that perhaps will occasionally show up.
And not to bring up a taboo subject, but that's one of the problems with hydrofracking, is that if you're hydrofracking an area and you happen to hit one of these wells, it gives you a very easy way to get the hydrofract fluids to the surface and therefore possibly into the water supply.
Okay. No, it's not a taboo subject here. It's actually mentioned fairly often. Thanks for the call, Bill. We appreciate it very much. Over to Will in St. Johnsville. Will.
Hey, hi.
Hi.
Years ago, I had a Volkswagen with an analog clock, brought it in for service one time, the car, not the clock, and when I got it back, the clock was running backwards. The dealer could never explain it. They said that they called the Blaupunkt people in Germany who manufactured the clock. No one could ever explain it. Ran backwards for a month, and then it stopped running backwards, ran forward.
Huh. It stopped without anybody doing anything and ran forward?
Sounds like a time warp to me.
Yeah, evil spirits, I think, was the cause of that.
Well, if it didn't change back, you could make some sort of hypothesis of why, right? Maybe just reverse, like a DC that was running on reverse terminals, maybe?
Don't know.
No, well, they couldn't explain it. They said that's impossible.
Maybe it was running forward too fast.
Impossible. It can't be running backwards.
Did you say it was a digital clock or an analog clock?
Ooh. Analog. It's 35 years ago.
Ah, okay.
Wow. So no one's got an answer for that?
Well, it's who knows? Maybe maybe somebody crossed the wiring, and you know, it's probably a DC clock, and started it running backwards.
But it went back on its own. That's the
well,
thing.
Well, then the short got
that's
broken
gremlins.
Or something.
That's what we call
gremlins.
They said cross wiring couldn't possibly do it. The short couldn't. We do it.
There's a journal out there called the Journal of Irreproducible Results, and this is what it's all about. It's things that happen and we can't explain, and hopefully in the year 2096 someone will have figured it out.
Well, I bet you, Will, somebody out there listening to this program has either an idea or it's happened to them, and so we will wait. And, Will, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Bye now. Over to Frank in Poughkeepsie. Frank.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This is a call that has stimulated my curiosity for a number of years. Appliance plugs and small motors and Dremels and stuff like that, they're all coming through with a little magnet on the power cord.
Yeah, they're chokes.
And I'll tell you a funny story. I was down in an appliance store the other day, and I asked the young man that was supposed to be on the Geek Squad what that piece of magnetic material was for. And he said, well, it converts AC, DC. I think he was way off
base.
It's an RF
choke, isn't it?
It's an RF
choke. But I'd like to know if you know what it is.
Go on.
Well,
it's your turn.
I know that, you know, in radio equipment, sometimes you'll do that if it's generating interference. It's an RF choke. It'll stop the radio frequency interference to some extent.
Right. It's a
That's right. But I think what it does is it just smooths out the sine wave a little bit. I don't believe it changes anything from alternating current to direct current.
No, it's a ferrite core, and usually it's put there to keep radio signals, for example, that are coming across the wires in your house to get into a radio or something like that. And it effectively is a block. It just keeps that signal from getting anywhere. So,
and what material did you say it was made from?
Iron, right?
Yeah, it's an iron core. It's a ferrite core. It's not magnetic. It's just a piece of metal.
It's basically a filter.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what I thought it was. But when this young fellow that said he was on the Geek Squad knew everything about everything on Earth, I thought he was way off.
Yeah, well, look up RF choke. That's what they are.
I will.
He might be
a legitimate geek,
but he doesn't know everything.
Not yet. Not like us.
And to answer the clock question, it would be my opinion, having worked on automobiles and electric motors. I'm 72 years old. I've worked on them most all my life. That somebody hooked the wires up backwards. A DC motor, if you change the ground to the positive side or vice versa, you can get it to run backwards if it's
right,
particularly a motor that has two brushes in it.
Well, that was our theory, but the caller, Will, said that eventually it just changed back and worked properly on its own.
He also said that it was 30 years ago, so his memory might not be all that good.
Frank, you are a true skeptic. Well done, sir. Well played.
Thank you. Thank you. Right, bye-bye.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say, well, obviously what they did is they hooked the battery up backwards.
No.
No, I don't think
so. Let's go to Dylan in Pleasant Valley. Dylan, you're on.
Yes, hi. You know, with all this talk of glaciers, my question was how come when, you know, over the winter, you'll get the plow guys come and, you know, sometimes we'll get really, you know, 6 foot tall piles of snow. And, you know, I've noticed that sometimes it'll be April, end of April, May, and I'll still see, you know, remnants of an old snow pile there. And I was just wondering how come it takes so long for some of those larger piles of snow to melt, even, you know, after the weather gets
I think
gets
that's
hot.
A great question, because every now and then you'll just see one lone pile there, and it's kind of odd.
If you pile it thick enough, it's going to last longer. It's just a question of how thickly it's piled up.
And if it's a little shady?
Yeah. Usually, if you see that sort of thing, it may have been covered, for example, by rocks, by
leaves,
things like that. And so as a result, it lasts longer.
All right. Well, you know, that's a fairly simple answer. Thank you.
That was easy.
Thank you, Dylan. We appreciate the call. Well, this was good. I mean, you guys, you did pretty well. We have a couple minutes here. Anybody have anything brilliant to say?
I think we did great without Barbara.
You think so? And Barbara didn't email, so she wasn't listening. She was actually working.
It's hard to believe.
And?
Well.
No great insights here.
No great insights at all. Well, I guess we can recap our program. We talked about the supervolcano, and George says don't worry about it, right?
That's right.
Pretty much.
There's nothing you can do about it anyway.
You know, I heard nothing about gravity waves.
Nope.
Nothing about chemtrails.
Thank you for saying it now.
And nothing about rabies. It was an excellent show.
It was a positive experience. We appreciate it. And I guess we have time for another call here if we want to take one. The number is 800-348-2551. Usually we're going right up to the end, so we never have to really make small talk.
Well, that's because we've answered everyone's questions.
You think so? It was a very efficient show today.
One of the things about the supervolcano, you might ask the question, where would be a good place to watch that from?
The moon?
And the moon would be my guess.
Yeah.
Certainly orbit.
Well,
high Earth orbit, not low Earth orbit.
But we'll be all right over here.
There'll be some dust coming down out of the sky.
And the price of wheat will go way up.
See, that's the problem.
Is that akin
to nuclear winter? What they call nuclear winter?
That it's the same basic idea. You put enough dust into the atmosphere for long enough, and you affect the short term climate for a couple of years.
All right, 30 seconds left here. Let's see. Is this who is this on line two? Hello.
Hello.
Hi, you're on. You only have about 20 seconds.
20 seconds. First of all, those old clocks and cars used to be, they only use the electric motor to wind the spring up in them, and the spring made the clock work. So there may have been something mechanically that went awry with it.
All right.
Second of all, I want to know about how come we haven't developed travel for space probes that can travel at even 1% of the speed of light. We don't need the speed of light. Just 1% would make a huge difference.
Well, how are we going to talk about this with 12 seconds left of the program? We'll give it a shot. Thank you.
We need to adjust time so that we have time to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, we don't have it going that fast because you need an awful lot of fuel to do that.
Okay. Well, you know, we were really on a roll. We took the last call, and we blew the whole thing. So thanks to Ed Stander, George Shaw, and Jim Pickett. Thank you, guys. It was a fun show. We appreciate it. Thanks to everybody who called in.
Our support comes from the Department of Theater Arts, SUNY New Paltz, presenting the Arthur Miller drama A View from the Bridge through March 13th, newpaltz.edu/theater. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com. Haydenville Woodworking and Design, a group of artisans designing and building renovations, additions, new homes, custom cabinets, and furniture for over 30 years, haydenvillewd.com for virtual portfolio. And Apex Solar Power, Queensbury, New York, locally owned, installing solar panels, solar hot water, solar pool heating, apexsolarpower.com for information. Thanks again to Ed, George, and Jim. Thanks to you for listening and for all the great calls. Thanks to Zachary T. Malloy, our engineer. Paulette Ryder took the calls. Our producer, Jessica Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's another delicious Food Friday. Stay tuned now for news.